As I think about 2021, it's not about business. It's not about profit. It's not about what you should do. It's how are you individually going to create healthiness for yourself? Number two, how are we as a society, as a country, going to restore some level of healthiness?
Hello, all you amazing, rocktastic people out there. I'm your host, Tori, here with my co-host,
Stephanie.
And we are here to rock out on some real estate. Guys, we have an amazing kickstart to our season 2, episode 1, ready here for you. We have Oren Jacobson here. He is a top lead analyst in the market, and New Home Star is lucky enough to have him on our docket here to give you an overview quickly of what quarter one is going to look like for the market and what the trends are, as well as talk to us a little bit about, 2020 and COVID. Oren, thank you so much for being here with us today. We're really excited to have you.
I should take you everywhere I go to introduce me.
We'll go ahead and dive into some questions that we've been having for you. We've been really thinking about coming out of 2020 into the new market. What does that look like? Can you give us a quick summary of what you saw in the market last year?
I immediately think back to a meeting we had in the middle of March as everything was shutting down. And, there's a lot of uncertainty at that point in time. Dave, our CEO, Dave Rice, said, Oren, I want you to be honest, but also find me a reason for optimism, because none of us really know what's about to happen. And so I sort of laid out a scenario for people that was what I thought would be the best case scenario. And the best case scenario, which at the time I believed to be true and it ended up holding up, was that because this was a healthcare crisis and not a financial crisis, that the overall credit markets would hold up. And therefore you wouldn't get into this big systemic cascading effect, which would dramatically impact the entire economy a la 2008. You probably remember us spending time saying this wasn't 2008. The second thing I said was, you could have a situation in which people are now locked in their homes for months, and they're staring at things they don't like, and they're feeling cramped, and they're also having a collective, and I use this framework, a collective near-death experience. Right, the idea of this invisible bug that can kill you in a matter of a week or two is scary, especially in the early phases when you don't know anything. And I said that those factors, if people arrived at a place where they no longer feared losing their job and this other psychological impact of being stuck in your home and the things you don't like and this near death, I got to go live my life type emotion collided, that you could actually end up with a really, really positive outcome for housing. And sure enough, that's what happened, right? You had interest rates stay very low. Supply on market was even lower than normal, because a lot of people didn't put up their homes for resale because it took time to figure out what to do and how to sell your house virtually. And that put home builders in a really good spot. And so, positive trends that we had been seeing over the last several years in the new construction market in particular accelerated because of that combination: low supply, low rates, and this new demand force. And so that's most of what you saw in 2020.
So I know you mentioned it's almost like a perfect storm that you just put together here. How did the pandemic specifically manipulate the market into one of the biggest housing booms since 2008? Or was this inevitable? Were we kind of heading in this direction already?
I don't think anything is inevitable. I think we would have had a good year. I don't know that it would have been as good or as hot as it became. I really think that most home buyers are what we'd say, conditional home buyers, meaning, they're emotional home buyers, not conditional home buyers. Most of them are not relocating, right? Most of them are making a decision to change their life. There's something about their current setup, whether it's they're in an apartment, they want to buy their first home, or they're in their first home and it's too small and they want to buy a bigger home for their family, or they're moving down because the kids are leaving and they want to downsize, whatever they're doing. Most of those things are emotional. It's about the life you want to live. And in our day-to-day lives, it is really easy to delay our gratification on major purchases. And it's probably smart in a lot of cases to delay, especially with something this massive. But this is a major, major decision. And so what I think happened, and this is sort of my psychological story that I just mentioned before, is lots of people who had previously thought about moving were in a very constrained life situation now and sort of being reawakened to their own mortality and to how many things had been taken away from them that gave them joy that they couldn't have. And that's the type of thing where, like, you hear people tell stories all the time, like, I had this near-death experience, or, you know, I beat cancer and I'm no longer going to take these things for granted. I'm going to go do this. I just went skydiving and I just went to Machu Picchu and, like, all these things that you put off for another day. I think all of that sort of played together. And then on the macroeconomic side, right, low rates make things affordable. And then the market state, like the stock market stabilized and the stock market started to grow. And so, you know, most people who buy new construction are in the top kind of quarter of the income bracket and quarter of the wealth bracket. And so all those things sort of work together to push new housing forward, especially when you don't have a lot of resale supply.
I also have been seeing that there has been a huge increase in demand for new construction over the past year. What do you think is a tribute to that versus not necessarily seeing, like, you know, we're seeing resale kind of decrease and more people moving towards new construction?
You know, styles change, right? What is modern and in changes. And if you think about what it means to have a 10-year-old house or a 20-year-old house as the alternative, if you go look at a home built in 2010, 2008, 2009, the bones may be great, the location may be great, but the cabinet colors are terrible and all those trends have changed. And so if you also think about the last economic recession slowed down a bunch of housing construction in 2007, 8, 9, 10. The market of new building constrained. It contracted vis-a-vis previous years. And so that means that the availability of even a 10-year-old home in the marketplace is less likely. So you add those two things together, and again, it sets up conditions for new. I also think that there's been an acceleration in the last 3, 4, 5 years, especially as technology has sort of become so integrated that the design trends and the styles and the colors, which used to take 5 years to move from, like, the major urban metros through the rest of the economy, that's being accelerated so quickly because of the way technology is integrating for customers, that it makes the appeal of new construction more attractive because all of a sudden you're looking at something that's 3 years old and feels outdated. And so I think that sort of feeds into some of the opportunity for us.
So what do we see now that you're coming into 2021? And obviously with it being one of the hottest markets since 2008, when is this boom, if you will, expected to be over? Is it expected to be over? What are we seeing in 2021?
You know, I think 2021, the projection would be similar to what we had in 2020, that it should be a strong, at the national level, it's too much to dive into market by market, but at the national level, the conditions for another strong year for housing exist. There are some sort of potential hurdles to that, but the expectation is that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to do what is necessary to ensure the liquidity markets stay stable, which means mortgage rates should still stay in a generalized low place. Generalized low to me at this point means under 6%, but we've been there for so long. Whether it's 2.5, 3.5, 4.5, I don't know, but those are still historically low rates. It's almost certain that Congress, I shouldn't say it's certain, but it's highly likely that the next Congress under the new administration is going to seek to pass additional economic support on the, I don't know if you want to call it stimulus or what you want to call it, but there'll be more economic support, whether it's greater checks to the American people, or what I think is going to come faster is going to be some type of legislation, or I shouldn't say faster, but after some initial additional payments come out to folks, is probably some focus around infrastructure and rebuilding roads, bridges, schools, ports, airports, expanding broadband, all of these things that you need to have a healthy, vibrant economy, which is going to put people to work. And just as a byproduct of hopefully getting this thing under control, which is going to take some time still, this thing being the pandemic, as the world starts to open up and you start to turn the corner in this summer, hopefully, where a great percentage of the population has been vaccinated, you're just going to see more economic activity. And so that should lift everything. Like I said, there are some warning signs, there's some concerning points. One is obviously what happens to house cost vis-a-vis commodity prices. We've seen lumber, as an example, shoot up. And to the extent that there continues to be a lack of availability of viable resale alternatives in areas people want, and the combination of house price and interest rate allow for a good enough affordability setup in the marketplace, you can absorb that and keep moving. What's hard to say is market by market, how much of a price push can you take based on house cost with the interest rate before that affordability changes and you start to lose some of the demand that you'd already have. So that's an equation I can't answer to any specific market. So I think that's sort of where 2021 is. And that's, you know, one of the two warning signs. The other potential warning sign, I think, is a longer term warning sign, which is Wall Street's disconnected from Main Street. And it has been for a while, right? The average American, when I say average, I'm thinking about the 50%, like who's the median person in America. The bottom 50% of Americans, most of whom don't buy new construction, are experiencing a Great Depression level catastrophe. The stock market, though, is reaching and continues to set new records. Those gains are being absorbed in the top 1, 5, 10, 20% who have some level of stock, whether it's in their 401k or individual stock. And what you end up having is the potential for equity valuations to be artificially inflated because investors don't believe that the Federal Reserve and Congress are going to turn off the spigot. And so there's very limited risk, right? So if there's limited risk, you keep going. And that's how you end up in bubbles. That's how you end up in a situation where there is a market bubble. Today, I don't see that bubble existing inside of housing, but you do see that bubble starting to look like it's there inside of equities and in the stock market writ large. And that eventually could cause a problem. But when, if, and how are to be determined, and a lot of things would have to happen. And just because there is a bubble today doesn't mean you have a big burst and a massive problem, because there's lots of things that can happen between now and the point that that problem would become dangerous for the overall economy.
What advice would you give to home builders as we move into 2021?
Focus as much as you can on providing affordable options to the marketplace and be very, very conscious about the way that affordability is moving. I recognize that when you're talking about house cost increases, because lumber goes up, you've got two options. You make less profit or you pass the cost on to the consumer. Those are your options. And most business people are going to first try to pass the cost. That's also logical. They've got to be careful about managing the affordability puzzle in their local market. That's number one. Number two is I would be careful about getting into land deals that are too long right now. And I say too long, I mean like that's sort of our 3, 4, 5, 6 year commitments. I don't know that a lot of people are doing that. I just think that there's so many variables at play right now that those types of things aren't ideal for their balance sheets and for their overall strategy, because there is just, it's hard to know exactly what this post-pandemic world starts to look like. And there's going to be some housing policy that I think will impact decision making. But those are the two things sort of top of mind. The third thing I would say is not really a piece of economic advice, but it's more of a recognition that we're never going backwards as an industry. And the consumer experience has forever changed. The more millennials start entering the marketplace as they are now in greater and greater numbers, the more Gen Z, who are not quite there yet, but will be within the next 5 years, starting to be those first time home buyers coming to the marketplace, their expectations and interests in sort of the traditional, as we know it, way to sell and buy homes is going to be very, very different. So anybody who thinks that virtual sales are going to retreat as the traditional model experience comes back needs to sort of rethink that. And I'm not accusing any builder partner out there of thinking that. I just think it's going to accelerate. And so, you know, one of the things that I love about what New Home Star does, because it is entirely focused on the sales and marketing side of this business, is how much intentional effort is going in right now to develop all of the people who are on the front lines working with the consumer in their skills in this place. Because without that skill set in the future, you're going to really struggle to meaningfully engage consumers.
That was such a perfect segue for my next question, Oren. What advice now would you give the sales associates as we move into 2021?
You've got to be an expert on how to do this virtually. That's it. I mean, to the extent that you didn't already buy in, I think you need to put those reservations aside and double down and triple down and really become very, very comfortable. And I would put this in a different way. I don't want to offer it as a, if you can't evolve, you're going to lose your place inside of the industry because the market or the consumer is going there. One of the worst things about being in new home sales is the lifestyle constraints that it places on sales professionals, right? Like lots of family stuff happens on Saturday and Sunday, and people are, you know, your customers are working 9 to 5 in most cases, right? So that means that you end up with late evenings and weekends. And so you should see technology as a democratizer and an enabler of a different type of lifestyle for you. There is still going to be a need for open models and those models to be open on weekends and for those models to be staffed. And that's going to mean you're going to be spending some, you know, you're never going to detach from that. But if it were me, I'd be saying to myself, how do I get to the point where I am meeting and exceeding my goals, working on my own schedule so that nobody can question my ability and commitment. I can create flexibility for myself based on my performance, and that performance is going to be dedicated by my ability to generate business and convert sales in this new world. And I think most builders and most sales managers would say, I got to have my coverage. I got to have professional engagement with my customers. But if you're able to meet and exceed sales and margin goals for me, and you can do that in a new way, that most of them are going to be like, okay, let's do that. Because otherwise, those people eventually leave the industry or they go try to do something else because life, you know, we want a life. That would be my argument. I think that's the number one thing to focus on in my mind. And the only other thing that I would say to people is, like, you don't need to be an economist. You don't need to dig into the market stuff the way that I dig into the market stuff for the work that I do. But you've got to have a good understanding of what's going on around you. And one of the unfortunate realities of a healthy market, it enables salespeople to skip a lot of steps to be successful. You forget, you sort of mix up the idea of hitting a double versus being born on second base, right? Like, you can be successful in this market not doing the things that you should do. You won't be successful the next time the market contracts if you're not doing those things. And that's pretty straightforward.
Our last question for you before we wrap it up with our interview is, what are some of your biggest takeaways from 2020 that you hope will translate into 2021?
My takeaways are, it's hard for me to think about 2020 through a business perspective or an economic perspective. I mean, it's just too heavy of a year to like have that be a dominant factor in my mind, even though I had to spend so much time and thought sort of trying to help guide the organization with the COVID task force and all the analysis we were doing there. One is that people are very resilient and can really face and overcome obstacles that you wouldn't imagine. If you would have told me at the beginning of last year that we would have had a pandemic that shut down the ability for everybody to engage in person for the better part of, you know, 90 days for sure and 9 months in meaningful ways, that you would have accomplished what you accomplished in terms of sales results, I would have told you you were crazy. I hope that the resiliency continues, and I hope that people sort of pocket this in their head as they face different challenges of what they can do when they see those challenges, number one. Number two, I think that I'm very worried about people's health and well-being right now on an individual level, as well as on a collective, you know, societal level. I think these conditions are very difficult to be healthy in as a human, to have no, you know, limited contact and all the stresses that 2020 has brought us, you know, from what I think is the most intense election since potentially 1860 to what I hope to be an awakening on racial justice in America. And time will tell whether or not organizations and institutions and people make the type of structural reformations that are required to have that be the last time or just another time. All of those things to me make it just really difficult to be healthy, especially when you're detached. And I remember a conversation with Dave in the middle of the summer where thing I said to him is like, as a business leader right now, the only outlet for your people is inside of the four walls of your business. They can't be with their family in most cases. They don't get to go to church in most cases. They don't get to go to community groups or to have people at their homes. I mean, obviously plenty of people did and too many didn't. That's part of the reason why we're still in this mess. But those things are gone. And even if they're doing them, they're not doing the same sort of carefree nature that they could before. And so all that energy has to be directed somewhere. And that means it's going to be directed here for both good and bad. I said it to him as a way of saying, like, if you're getting beaten up for things, which you are going to get beaten up for things because you're the leader, it's going to be more intense for the foreseeable future because the outlets aren't there. So as I think about 2021, it's not about business. It's not about profit. It's not about what you should do. It's how are you individually going to create healthiness for yourself, because we're still going to be in a little bit of a tough spot here for 6, 7, 8, 9 months. Number two, how are we as a society, as a country, going to restore some level of healthiness? And I don't mean, you know, the sort of the fake civility or the fake harmony because you just sweep stuff under the rugs, but I mean like the real conversations that actually are about respectful disagreement and engagement meaningfully and seeing and hearing people who we've been ignoring for far too long. And I don't know how those things are going to unfold, but those are the things that I think about that 2020 sort of threw on our laps in the most aggressive way possible. That's where I am. And by the way, I would add that I hope builder partners out there recognize the unique opportunity that the way work is changing provides. There is a better quality of life for everybody when they can be with their family more. And we've established this work culture in America, which is like, it's not 40 hours a week, it's 60 hours a week. You go to Spain and you got a 2-hour lunch nap,
siesta. You know,
followed by a late dinner, like they got the siesta. So like there are real meaningful benefits to embracing this change, and your people will want to stay a part of your organization longer if you are creating a meaningful improvement in their quality of life. If you resist those things, they will end up somewhere else and you will lose because of the thrash of turnover and the loss of talent and all those things. And so I think there's a meaningful investment into that that builders should think about and organizations should think about in how they do this moving forward. And by the way, that will also help people be more healthy, right? The ability to sit down and have lunch with your kids is a thing that most people don't get every day, but have had for the last 9 months, and they might not like the homeschooling piece of this equation, but the I can take my kid to school, I can pick my kid up from school, I can spend an hour with them afterwards before they go play, and I can do my work around those things could make such an amazing difference in the health and wellness of your people, our communities. And by the way, I think happier people are more productive people.
That's a great note to wrap up our questions on, because I just think that you couldn't get a much better answer than that one. So we're going to transition into Stephanie's favorite part of our podcast, which is our rapid fire questions. Stephanie, do you want to tell them how it works?
Absolutely. So the way it works is I will ask you 10 very random questions and you will just give me the first thing that comes to mind. Are you ready?
Oh, God.
All right. What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?
Skydive.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
My biggest pet peeve is people who are convinced they know history, but they don't.
What's on your nightstand?
A phone charger, tweezer, and usually an empty bowl of grapes.
What's the one thing that lives in your car?
A mask.
When do you feel inspired?
Every day.
What was the last thing you binge watched?
Bridgerton.
What is your favorite morning ritual to inspire you for the day?
For me, it's an hour every morning of reading curated stuff before anybody else gets to touch me. Nobody gets to talk to me. I don't respond to texts or emails. Doesn't matter if Dave Rice is calling. Until my hour of reading is done, you don't exist.
What's your all-time favorite book?
Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin, about Lincoln and his cabinet.
If you could describe yourself in one word, what would it be?
A bit much. Is that one word?
It could be a bit much.
My word would be serious. I'm a very serious person.
If you could be remembered for one thing, what would it be?
If I could be remembered for one thing, I would want to be remembered as a true ally in the fight for racial justice.
On all of our podcasts, my favorite part is asking a peer learning question of the week. Peer learning is a section on our community platform where all of our sales associates can actually go and ask questions and have real live answers from other sales associates across the country, have them come out and answer. And so we always will pick a question that kind of relates most to our people that we're interviewing. And so I hope we have a good one for you and I think you'll like it. So Oren, what advice do you have for completing a competition study analysis without any comps in the area?
Without any comps?
Yes, that is the one someone posted on our platform.
I assume this means there are no comparable builders?
Yes, that's what I was taking it as.
Look, if there's no comparable builders, then I think the way you do this is to actually be really, really thorough about what you have So you're a true expert on what's going on with you. And then you've got to dig into the resale market in particular. If there's not like truly competitive, let's say there's no home builder in your submarket that is building homes between 300 and 400,000 for like 25 miles or whatever the submarket parameters are. It's probably not that much, but you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it's you against resale. You got to be an expert on the resale market. You got to understand everything that's happening. You got to know, you know, you got to dive into the actual details of the listings on the market that you think are the most attractive. Understand how you're positioning against those resale homes. That would be my advice.
Oren, thank you again so much for coming out. We have enjoyed having you here so much. I'm Tori, here with my co-host,
Stephanie.
This was New Home Stars Real Estate Rockstar Podcast. I hope you guys felt like your real estate was rocked out, and thanks for checking us out, and we'll see you guys again soon.